Welcome to Big Blend Radio, where we celebrate variety and how it adds spice to quality of life. Welcome, everybody. Today, we are thrilled to have Edward Greene join us to talk about his memoir. It's called On the Fringe, Confessions of a Maverick Anthropologist. It is out now, so go check it out wherever you get books, Amazon, maybe your local bookstore. That's always a good thing. You know, Nancy and I got excited to hear about his book and also, of course, start reading it. Ted has been through many countries that Nancy and I have, Kenya, South Africa, a lot of Africa, and around the world. He's a retired American medical anthropologist, and he served as a senior research scientist at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies. And he later became the director of the AIDS Prevention Research Project, and he's currently research professor at George Washington University. He was also appointed a member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS from 2003 to 2007, and served in the Office of AIDS Research Advisory Council for the U.S.-based National Institutes of Health from 2003 to 2006. Cool. You know what? He's got a long, long list of things he's done, and that's why he can write a memoir. And I love his memoir because he is very raw and honest, and very excited to have you here on the show. Ted, how are you?
I'm okay. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, doing good. Doing good. Nancy and I are excited to hear that you are going back to South Africa, you know, right after we record this in a few days, but, you know, that you also share some familiar surroundings. Kenya, that was, you know, where I was raised as a very young child. And it sounds like we have some similar circles of people that we know.
Well, this might go back to when I first became interested in anthropology. It was probably the night my mother took my brother and me to hear the famous Dr. Louis Leakey give a lecture about his hominid finds in Kenya, held at the Swanky Cosmos Club in Washington, D.C. My mother told us boys that normally we'd have to have a PhD just to walk through the front door, so we better keep a low profile and behave ourselves. I was a freshman in junior college. And by the way, women weren't allowed in the Cosmos Club back then. They had to come in a side door. Things are different now. Anyway, Dr. Leakey gave a very interesting talk. And at the end, there was time for questions and answers. But I have to say, I was embarrassed over the quality of the questions. Things like, oh, Dr. Leakey, weren't you afraid of attacks by the Mau Maus? And this is in the 1950s. Weren't you afraid of getting tropical diseases? I mean, nothing even really qualified as a scientific question. So I started to put my hand up to ask a question while my brother tried to pull my arm down and hissed at me, don't embarrass me. Well, I asked a question about exactly how we define tool usage, since this seems to be an important inflection point in human evolution from lower primates to modern man. Well, the great Dr. Leakey said this was the first, or he said this is the best question he's heard all evening. He answered my question as well as he could, but suggested that I write to Dr. Jane Goodall, chair of the National Geographic Society, to get the very latest reports about how chimpanzees were, you know, trimming branches and sticks so they could push them into rotting logs and pull out termites. Thus encouraged, I followed his advice. And about 6 months later, I received a letter. Well, to be honest, it was a postcard, but Goodall used very tiny script, and she wrote quite a bit in that diminutive postcard. So when I first took my first cultural anthropology course the following year, the professor started to share some rather outdated information about chimpanzees and tool usage, prompting me to put up my hand and say, well, yeah, we used to think that. But I was just talking about this very topic with Louis Leakey a few months ago. And he suggested I write to Jane Goodall. She answered me promptly. And so now we know, you know, I don't usually behave this way, but I couldn't resist this opportunity.
I love this because I think, yeah, anthropology is very much like science, right? In that it's always changing. And I think it's a hard thing for people to swallow, especially, I mean, look at what's happening in the world now. Even when we look at climate change and things like that, that it's like when science changes, a new discovery is found. I know that, you know, we were just talking about this the other day that, you know, one of the oldest, you know, They dug up like a hummingbird in Germany. Like we think of hummingbirds being in the Americas, right? Not in Germany. And people don't believe that, but it's like, yeah, look at what just happened. So it changes everything we know. And that's what happens with science. That's what happens with anthropology. They hold hands. And so it's really hard because people go, well, you keep changing your mind, so therefore it's not true. But it's every time we have a discovery, isn't that evolution in
It's
itself?
accumulative, and sometimes we have to give up old paradigms and embrace new paradigms, about which more later, because I got in trouble for challenging the prevailing paradigm about AIDS prevention.
And that's the thing too. I wanted to touch on, we were actually in South Africa at that time, traveling the country. Nancy was on tour with her artwork, raising funds for the Cancer Association. And we ended up doing a lot of, we went to universities. I remember being in a university for dinner. And it was one of the, and I wish I could remember where it was. And it was near Ladysmith, I think. And it was an all black university. And it was a big deal at that time. And at that time, AIDS was just flourishing, you know. And
What year was this, more or less?
this has got to be the late 80s. I'm thinking mid to late 80s.
Before we
And
had effective cures, treatment or treatments, I should say, for AIDS.
yeah. And people, I remember the actual, you know, the head guy of the university, and I was still like in my early teens, like 14 maybe, 13 or 14 years old, going, well, AIDS is coming down from Rhodesia on trucks. And we're looking at him like, what are you talking about? You know, because no, everybody had different stories about where AIDS came from. And I mean, at one point, people were saying it was coming from monkey. I mean, it was like this whole thing that, and then in, you know, going, you know, later England and then South Africa, you know, well, sorry, South Africa, then growing up through that, it just, you started to see it here. And I don't think people really understood the cultures. And that's where I love about your book and your story is that you started to understand the people instead of just going, here, this is what everyone must do now and not understand because change doesn't happen. You know, when Nancy went around with wildlife conservation, she was doing talks about not killing lions and things like that. And she put up a photo of a lion in a hut at this time. She was talking to different Maasai tribes. And one of them in the back threw a spear into the photo of the lion, you know, and because she didn't understand the culture at that time. And it took time. And so I think that's important. So going from actually the anthropology side to working with the cultures of that moment in current times, I think sometimes going backwards helps to go forwards, right? And actually understand a culture of where they come from and who they
That's, I
are.
mean, that's exactly what I tried to do. To me, the things I did were like anthropology 101, the kinds of things that anybody should have started with. But I don't want to get ahead of maybe the order of the questions you have.
No, I know. Let's do start actually with your life becoming an anthropologist. Like now, of course, we've got your inspiration for that, right? But also your family not understanding maybe and having a different plan for you, just like what was happening during AIDS. Hey, this is how you're going to do things. And you being kind of a rebellious person going, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Your mom probably wasn't real happy with you.
No, and by the way, my mom was named Lisa. Maybe I told you
Oh
that.
boy. Yes.
One of the themes in my book is imposter syndrome, and in my book, I speculate that this goes back to my expulsion from an elite boarding school, Groton, at age 15. My mother seemed to be truly traumatized by this, reminded me quite often, especially after the age of 15, that she considered me a failure. My whole life has been a failure. She saw nothing in my future but failure. And indeed, I was rebellious as a youth, and I liked to smoke and drink beer and hang out with undesirable kids. Yet part of me wanted to prove my mother wrong. As my career began to develop and take off, I always felt deep down that I was really a failure, a fraud, and that the day would come when my colleagues would and the general public would expose me as a total imposter. I was inspired to write this memoir because I learned that I'm far from alone in feelings of low self-confidence. In fact, there was a blog discussion on the imposter syndrome a couple of years ago, and I heard It was the second most widely watched or followed of any well-known blogger and medical doctor. So there are many more people out there who suffer from this than we know about. And because most people probably prefer not to admit this about themselves. You know, an old classmate from my high school in Korea called me up last week. I haven't seen this guy since 1962. And he said, "Oh, wow, you know, I suffer from imposter syndrome, and it's great to know that he's not alone in his secret fears. And thanks for my courage and forthrightness to write this memoir." Ditto, one of my professional colleagues who read an early draft of my memoir, he went on and revealed some very personal things like fears he didn't deserve his position. Yet I looked up to him as a leading professional in our field. I think we all wear a professional mask that we hide behind, and we fear that people might not like to see what's behind our masks.
I absolutely agree, and I think it's probably more prevalent than what we think. I think everyone has some degree of imposter syndrome because, you know, they always said, like, fake it till you make it, right?
Right.
You know, it's part of it, and it's part of our ego needing to move forward, but not having the self-confidence is difficult, especially when you're in a career of academia. You are with, you know, professors and things that where you can be called out, you know, yet you are also rebelling
right.
about the system.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's a balance that you are carrying, which is pretty
Yeah,
intense.
I think you're right. It's a matter of degree. You know, some people are little affected by it. Other people have downright panic attacks at the worst possible time. In my book, I talk about a disastrous job interview at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, I was totally pretty good about myself. They flew me all the way from Mozambique to Baltimore and back because they were, you know, really interested in hiring me. In fact, I heard that they'd already planned to hire me. And they asked me for my PowerPoint. You know, this was 1994. I'd been living in Africa. I didn't really know what a PowerPoint was. So, you know, it was a pretty disastrous. And all these, you know, famous in AIDS and public health, all these famous professors at Hopkins and people from USAID, I didn't handle it well, and they ended up taking back the offer for the position.
Wow. And at the same time, you kind of walked away and went into Africa, right? And really working with the people. And I think that's also something really important that people understand. So there's that professor side, here's the people side, and then balancing that. Did working with people help you move forward past the imposter syndrome, or did it make it harder to? I always looked at it
When
as
you say
like
people, you mean like ordinary people in Africa and
people in
Asia and
Africa,
the Caribbean?
different,
I always felt more comfortable talking to the, you know, the vox populi, the average people than I did with fellow professors and people like that. It's probably because I know it's because I imagine what they expect, and I think, oh God, I'm really going to let them down when they see how little I actually know. So I had intrusive thoughts like that. But, you know, I come from a long line of successful people, especially on my mother's side, real blue bloods. I was undoubtedly a difficult child, one who today would be probably diagnosed as hyperactive or ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, more or less, backed up by my less insistent father, had my whole life planned out for me. Groton School, then Yale, where my father went, then an Episcopal bishophood or becoming a professor in an Ivy League school. I rebelled against all that and went out of my way to forge my own path. I think I told my mother once I was starting my sociological or anthropological research with the criminal classes. Then I was slowly worked my way up to her privileged class. I was aware I was starting to achieve, perhaps unconsciously, the very career goals that my mother was, you know, gradually pushing me towards. My older brother once commented to me that we three brothers are unlikely to ever be as successful as our father. He was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs and an ambassador to several countries. So my brother said, "Why should we even try?" I thought, maybe number one son, my brother Mark, is not going to play this sibling rivalry game with me, so maybe I have a chance. Not long after this, I pretty much had proof that Mark was indeed not even playing the game. Our younger brother, Brampton, had dyslexia, which meant he would not be competing academically with his two brothers, who would soon have PhDs.
Wow. And then then you walked away from that part of it, of the academia, and decided, I'm going into anthropology, the advocacy part of it.
Well, that wasn't, yeah, that wasn't so rebellious as it might sound. My great uncle was the chairman of anthropology at Harvard and the president of the American Anthropological Association. So, that was the other thing. If I wasn't going to be an Episcopal bishop, then it would be fine for me to be an anthropologist, just so I was at an Ivy League university. But by the way, you may have noticed in my book, I talk about the theory of sibling birth order. The firstborn is a keeper of the status quo, and the second son needs to overthrow the established order. There was a book by a Harvard professor called Born to Rebel that tries to approach this question scientifically, but it's kind of interesting.
Well, one thing I wanted to go into, you've got the imposter, syndrome, and then you go, you're in academia, then you go into anthropology, then you end up in the world of AIDS prevention, right? And you really rebelled more against the system of everybody wearing condoms. And I remember in Africa, the world of condoms coming, and I mean, it was in schools, we were, it was like, these are the new things. And in fact, I remember as a teenager, a friend of mine coming home from like a clinic or something and going, look at all of these condoms. And we blew them up like balloons. Just, I mean, we were kids, we were being stupid. You can't freeze them. But anyway, if you fill them with water. And it was interesting because none of, it was just this, but here we're the white kids, right? Which is different than the different tribal folks where they had different ways of working. And that's something you really did in regards to looking at what Uganda was doing and try to change things.
Well, yeah, let me tell that story. I first went to Uganda. It was a side trip from a consultancy I had in Tanzania, which was about AIDS. Anyway, I was invited to Uganda for a week. They were looking me over for a full-time job. I ended up not going there, even though later on I'd be associated with Uganda and got a prize from the president of Uganda, but let me not get ahead of myself. So I go to Uganda in 1993 just for a week, and I did the kinds of things I think an anthropologist would do. You know, key informant interviewing. I would look for doctors and nurses and religious people and the heads of nonprofit organizations. And it seems like I was the first person to notice that incidence, which follows HIV prevalence, was starting to go down. STD rates, we now call them STIs, sexually transmitted infections like syphilis and gonorrhea, were on the decline. And I was quite excited about this. And yet everybody was still saying in AIDS prevention, the best way to prevent AIDS is consistent use of condoms. Then in 1998, I was reading a World Bank book about AIDS. And this jumped out at me. It said, HIV is exploding all over Africa in particular. And yet this one country, this is not true for Uganda. Somebody needs to, send a consultant there just to look at what's going on, what the programs are, and what might account. Because by 1998, it was generally accepted that HIV was going down in Uganda. Mm-hmm. So I thought, wow, I'd love to have that job. Well, 2 weeks later, the phone rings, and it's a consulting firm that works with the World Bank. Would I like to go to Uganda and do this very job that was, outlined in this book? And I said, well, normally I would, but my father just died, and I'm feeling sad and depressed. Another time, don't forget to call me back. But by the way, what was the job? And it was the very same job that was described. So I went and did more of the same. And I came back saying, it was not to do with condoms. In fact, data showed that only 4 condoms per male per year were in use, which is slightly lower than the Africa-wide, statistics.
Yet, so Uganda, they weren't having, so their AIDS, cases, number of AIDS cases was going down, yet they weren't doing the condoms like.
They weren't doing condoms. What were they doing? They were discouraging having multiple concurrent sexual partners.
Wow.
And they were advising young people not to begin to have sex. If you've already started, you might want to stop, because there's a deadly disease around. And if you haven't started yet, good. Don't get started. So I said it was behavior change. It was a behavioral approach. It wasn't a technological fix like condoms or testing. And now in later years, drugs. We didn't have effective drugs back then.
No.
So,
no, we didn't. No,
so people didn't want to hear that.
No, no, because you were talking about behavioral changes, but it's also cultural. I mean, that's a cultural backbone of Africa. I mean, I got kicked out of school for hitting the Minister of Home Affairs' son. Turns out, this was when I was in Kenya and I was a little kid. It was like a whole, there's a whole story behind that we don't need to talk about. But this guy had the Minister of Home Affairs, Tip-Tip, had all these wives and so many kids. Like, I mean, he had like 50, 60 kids, but he had multiple wives.
This was in Kenya, right?
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying.
I think I met him. He said, don't do what I do. Do as I say, right?
Yeah. And so that's the thing. It's pretty much. So when you talk about having multiple sexual partners, we're not talking about, like in our country here in the States, it's like someone's promiscuous and you go through your early 20s or teens and you have multiple partners because of your hormones and what, you may be a bad boy or a bad girl, like you naughty, naughty, this is a cultural tradition of a man, like oftentimes having multiple partners and multiple wives, even.
But it turns out that's not true according to the best data we have from the demographic and health surveys. Yes, this is the startling fact that nobody wanted to accept. When you compare sub-Saharan Africans with Western Europeans and North Americans, they have fewer lifetime number of sexual partners. And what's the other one? Yeah, they start to have sex at a later age, unless we're talking about early marriage. And of course, you're having sex in marriage. President Museveni of Uganda then, and I'm sorry to say even now, came up with a wonderful metaphor. He worked with a friend of mine that I met at Harvard, Benon Nantulia, but he came up with a metaphor, zero grazing, which meant tether your bull in his corral so he doesn't go wander off and impregnate all these cows. And, this is a local metaphor. It was an endogenous approach to AIDS. It was African. Ugandans knew exactly what was meant. And that's what they did. And that's why HIV was coming down. So I had my World Bank report, which was put away in a lower shelf and World Bank pretended it never happened. And a colleague of mine, he became a colleague, Norman Hurst, was asked by the United Nations AIDS program, UNAIDS, to do a study of the effectiveness of condoms in AIDS prevention. And he found pretty much what I found out, that condoms played a very small role. I'm not to say they might not have played a larger role in Bangkok or even in the U.S., but in Africa, they didn't. And the statistics bore me out. And his report to UNAIDS was shelved, and they pretended they never asked for this. He published his findings in a major peer-reviewed journal, and we became friends and colleagues.
I wonder if, because when Nancy, my mom, went to Kenya, she started doing journalism work out there. It started with Oh my gosh, am I I'm going to get the wrong name. Kenyatta's death. And she went to actually photograph his funeral and got in trouble for it.
Yeah, Jomo Kenyatta.
Literally, no, they took her camera and took her away trying to do that. But at that time when we lived in Kenya, syphilis was just rife, in the 70s. And I
Yeah.
wonder if syphilis and through the African countries going through syphilis, if and it was, it was the Europeans getting it too. I wonder if Uganda learned something from that syphilis going around in the 70s that helped them learn to kind of abstain, the zero
Well,
grazing.
evidently they were. And, I could go on and on about the role of faith-based organizations and, but basically it was a delay of what we call sexual debut and reduction of multiple concurrent partners. And my critics immediately said, Green has become a holy roller. He's become a religious conservative. He's promoting abstinence only. Well, where do you get abstinence only from, delaying sexual debut as long as you can? Anyway,
Oh,
I some of my colleagues turned against me, and it hurt. Can't pretend it
yeah.
didn't hurt.
Does that now, when you look at that, when people read this, read your memoir, and I think it's a very important memoir that people read, and it's, understanding the role of even going through academia and choosing that career, which is not easy. Going to different countries is not easy for everyone. Understanding the different cultures, immersing yourself in it, but then rebelling against something, right? And then that in its own way is almost like a second version or second wave of the imposter syndrome, right? So it's almost like they're trying
Yeah,
to prove that. You know what I mean?
I have to say, I didn't pursue an academic career. Let's see. I did a couple of short term filling in for a professor on leave here and there, universities of West Virginia, University of Kentucky, and my mentor said, "Listen, Ted, you did field work at Suriname. No one's ever heard of Suriname, even anthropologists." So, why don't you see if you can use your family connections and somehow get a gig with USAID, have them send you to a country in Africa, especially a larger one that people have heard of. And, and then you'll come back and you'll be much more, marketable in academia. So I went off to do applied anthropology and I never turned back. I used to joke around, well, I'd be asked, "Do you ever think about returning to academia?" And I'd sarcastically say, "Well, I suppose if Harvard University offered me a job and I didn't have to go through a job interview, then yeah, then maybe I'd consider it." That's sort of what happened, but that's later on. But for most of my career, as you see in the book, I was an independent consultant. I was going first of all around Africa and the Caribbean, and then Southeast Asia and South Asia and Latin America and Eastern Europe and the Middle East. I was going everywhere as a consultant. And so by the time I, well, let me tell you about Harvard. So, because I was 56 years old when I returned to academia, and I left it decades earlier. So I inherited some property in Maine, and my wife said, "Yeah, why don't you get a job in Harvard? Then we could pretty much commute from here, an hour and a half from Cambridge." And I said, "Well, yeah, well, that sounds nice, but how would a guy like me at 56 get any kind of a position at Harvard?" Well, it happens that a listserv that I belonged to on public health happened to have the first and the last ad I ever saw for the Takami program at Harvard School of Public Health. Let me have a sip of water. And so
Absolutely.
I wrote to Harvard and said, "I've got this idea. It's not popular. It's not about condoms or testing. It's about not having multiple concurrent partners and delaying sexual debut. But I don't have, it was all the application was due on Tuesday and it was like Saturday. And I said, can I have an extra week?" And I got a letter back, said, "Yeah, okay, take an extra week." And So I got into that program, and that led to being offered a couple of 3-year, you know, renewable positions as a senior research scientist. I should mention the John Templeton Foundation, because when I started at Harvard, you know, I tapped into a little Gates Foundation money on an AIDS project in Nigeria, but I didn't have much money, and I did some consultancy as to, you know, to keep things together, and I've sort of lost my train of thought. Where was I?
No, I think it's because you're saying, you know, you didn't do that much of academia, and I'm going, yeah, you did.
Right.
But I think what's important is that you did the field work, and being a consultant, or even anybody out there that's doing any kind of moving and immersing themselves in, you know, place, like people put down traveling salespeople, and I hate that, because they actually know everything that's going on in communities as they travel. They know, they get to go in the back door of restaurants. They get to really get the heartbeat of the people, you know, and I know that sounds weird, but it's true. And I mean, I've been that my whole life, you know.
There's a whole field called social marketing. You know, if Coca-Cola can sell things anywhere in the world, then you know, and that's bad for you. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
But things like vitamins and contraceptives are good for you. So we can use people into social marketing, and I worked in that field. You know, we can promote contraceptives going through, you know, little down to people who push carts around and sell things on the street. So I did that. I should mention that I had credibility in when it comes to condoms, because I'd promoted family planning, and not just standard family planning and contraceptive social marketing, but even exotic ones involving indigenous or traditional healers in selling over-the-counter contraceptives. So I had that credibility, and then when I became a condom critic, and my colleagues in family planning said, you know, Ted's he's turned against us. He's you know, he's become a religious conservative.
Well, when just living over there, and we lived with two different tribes at one point in Kenya when Nancy worked for Joy Adamson, and because I wasn't allowed to be on the actual camp in the encampment because they were rehabilitating a leopard at the time. And what we learned from the different cultures, yes, there were what people want to call, like in South Africa is the Sangoma and Tokoloshe, like there's a good one, the good witch, the bad witch. There's, you know, the witch doctors, however you want to call them, shamans here, what everybody's got their terms. But what we learned was that it was actually psychology almost. It wasn't that they had these mystical powers like Merlin, right? It's like they're Merlins. You know, it was like wizards and all of that. But it was really about the power of thinking and the power mindset. And that's what we kind of learned. And that was what they had, like their own.
Yeah.
Today we have influencers on Instagram. That's what we found they had within their tribal system, where these were the influencers.
Belief in the efficacy of the medicines and the healers. I'm trying to think of a quote from my old mentor said long ago, I'm going to forget the quote now. Yeah, he said, like homeopathic and what's the other allopathic medicine, you know, begin on two diametrically opposed premises, and yet they both work for some people. So it's got to be the belief in the efficacy that is doing much of the healing. We could get into a side discussion about the efficacy of phytomedicines, herbal medicines. There's some evidence, and there's some in my book about you know, herbal medicines for example, STDs.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. It's every place is different too, and I think that's the other thing you bring out is every person is individual, and you definitely are your own individual. So the imposter syndrome, that I think is very interesting for people to read, because I feel like that actually propelled you further afield, like forward, and that helped your rebelliousness to do, I don't know, it's like a, it's almost like a
To channel it.
superpower.
Yeah, channel it in the right way. You know, I had a lot of trepidation about even publishing this book. I was especially worried about what my academic colleagues would think. I told my wife that if Russ Bernard, my mentor, strongly advised me not to release this book, I wouldn't release it. I'd pull it from the publisher. So I sent Dr. Bernard my manuscript, and I didn't hear back from him for what seemed like forever. And then Russ phoned me and said he thought I wasn't, his emails were not getting through to me for some reason. That's right. I wasn't seeing any response. He had the manuscript of my book. He quickly assuaged my anxiety by telling me that he liked my book a lot. Like he later told me through an intermediary, he'd never read anything like it. So,
Wow. No,
that, and
it's
he told me this. Some of my colleagues might think the book is unprofessional and too self-absorbed, but he said, hey, to hell with them, right?
yeah. No, I think you have a heck of a story, and I'm excited for our audience to dig into your memoir. Everyone, you can get it online, get the paperback, go to AmazonBookshop.org, all those places, and even go to your bookstore and ask them to get it for you. There's always that, which we love.
There's an
But I and
audiobook version.
that's
Did you know?
no, that is huge. Most
Yeah.
people I know are, that's how they ingest their books, is through audio,
Know,
and
I happened to meet a blind guy socially about a week ago, and he said, "Oh, I'd love to read your book, but I'm blind." And I said, he said, "By any chance, is there an audio version?" I said, "I just found out yesterday that there is.
that's
Nobody told."
fantastic.
Nobody told me about it. I wasn't asked to read it. Some guy I've never heard of read the book, and more power to him and to my publisher. But he mispronounces pretty much all the foreign terms.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone's Kenya or Kenya, depending on what country you come from either, But I think the audio is huge. I know that we have a friend who's also blind and actually tours the world, talking about blind technology, especially for the world and music, and he's always like, every time we do an author, he's like, was it on audio? And I'm like, yes, it is. No, it's not. And I have, a lot of times the audio comes so much further down the road, it's like, I think it should all come out at once. That's just my
Yeah, I
personal
do too. And
opinion.
I don't know how it happened, and no one told me, and I just happened
I'm
to
glad.
find it. My book's actually on about a dozen different book selling sites. One of them in Korean, and
That's
I thought,
amazing.
now how did that happen? Well, maybe they learned that I went to high school in Korea.
And World Health. I mean, you're also, I think that there's interesting connections with the World Bank too. When it's something global, it's of global interest. And we all have ties back into these magical places that have, Africa is like, what the most beautiful things in Africa are often the most poisonous, or most deadly. But and that's the thing. And you went to these places and still continue to do so, which is awesome. And when you live there, you can't go to Africa on a 2-week safari and think you understand the actual continent of Africa by going on a 2-week safari. You actually have to live there for a couple years, I think, and get your, fingers in the dirt. And you
Of course,
really do.
I had done that with the descendants of enslaved African peoples in the Western Hemisphere, in the Amazon forest in Suriname. That's my first field work, and that was great field work. I mean, when the Dutch plantation owners caught runaway slaves, they would literally skin them alive or had them drawn and quartered. This is in the 16, 1700s, terrible torture and stuff. And here I was showing up as a white guy with my young wife and my 1-year-old son and our large shaggy German Shepherd mixed dog, and they accepted us willingly, open arms. When I first went to Swaziland, I wondered if I could do the same thing. And a few weeks into my ended up being a 4-year job, I went to a community, and I asked the sub chief, are there any huts that aren't being used around here because my wife and I would like to, you know, maybe hang out on. Oh yeah, that one right over there is my grandson's off in school, so you can have his hut. Like it's the most natural thing in the world. Can you imagine? I have an anthropologist friend, Jean Lenoir, who did field work in a neighboring tribe in Suriname. He's from a small town in Oklahoma. He said he asks himself, what would his people think and his neighbors if a dark black skinned person showed up with a notebook and a tape recorder and said, I'm here to study you people.
I
Got
love it.
any spare houses?
Yeah, I love that because, you know, it is different. I mean, when we were in Kenya, I mean, there was very few white people and at that point, you know, Nancy is a single mom, you know, single woman in Africa. And I mean, to even open a P.O. box, she'd have to go on the street and find a guy and have them pretend she
A
was a
single mom
husband.
like Barack Obama.
Yeah, there you go. Oh boy, that's going to be a big drama. But yeah, I mean, she, you know, going was just different. And she did what there was a very British colonial culture there. And they had servants
Oh
and
yeah.
would ring bells at the table. And Nancy refused to do it. And she got, you know, basically got herself ousted from the white colonials when we lived in Kenya.
Oh,
They
well, good
basically,
for her.
yeah.
Yeah, good for
Because
her.
you did, everyone did have servants. And if you didn't, they would rob you at times because it was like, hey, if you're going to be here, you need to put back into the community and culture. And like
And
I said,
back
I
into the
mean,
economy.
yeah,
Into the
into the
economy, because
economy.
so many
Yeah.
people need work.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And so we did.
when my wife and I, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I'll
Go
just say,
ahead.
when my wife and I were in Swaziland, this is unusual for USAID contractors, but they thought, wouldn't it be an interesting idea to give how, excuse me, provide housing for contractors similar to the way ordinary Swazis live? This is not a thatch hut, but, you know, middle-class Swazis. So we had this little humble abode, and, you know, all these women were knocking on our back door wanting to be our maid, our cook, whatever. And we said, no, we don't want one. And we were under pressure, and our neighbors who worked on the same project were under pressure. So we decided to share a cook. So that's how we got around that.
Yeah, no, we had to. And, you know, Nancy had one gentleman worked for her, and she, like, you know, at dinner time, let him sit at the table, and it freaked everybody out. And she was learning from him, and it became a big deal. But in South Africa, it was a little bit different, but it was Kenya that was really super, you
Well,
can't do
we
this.
had we had white Kenyans, settlers in Kenya that after the Mau Mau rebellion and thereafter came down to South Africa and to Swaziland. So I know some white Kenyans who moved to Swaziland, you know, to do farming what they had done in Kenya.
Yeah, no, Kenya, it's a magical, I mean, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, that whole area. I mean, I love Africa. I mean, I'd live there again if we could. You know, it's just it's a very real place, and people are, you know, there is the sense, and it was what you were talking about, you know, getting the hut, you know, there is a village, and that's what, when we came over back home to this country in the States, and I mean, we went to a grocery store and didn't understand how to even buy things here because there was just an
Oh,
abundance,
just
and I was
overwhelmed, right?
overwhelmed. I'm like, my first thing is
That's the word, yeah.
I looked at Nancy and I said, why do we have, and this is so funny because I did this last year with my best friend from high school, came over to the States, and she lives in England now, but I took her to a store and she said, she went to exactly the same place I did and said the exact same thing, and I almost fell over. The first thing we did, we went to go get butter. That is one of your basic food things, right?
Yeah.
And I looked at Nancy and I'm like, why do we have so much butters? What's wrong with their butter here? Well, now I know. But I mean, that was my first instinct, is why do we have 10 butters? Butter is butter. Why do we have all these butter choices? Listen, my friend came over. She went right to the butters thing because we were all sharing a little vacation home together. Went to the butter and she looked at me. She says, why do you have so many butters?
Yeah.
And why do we? You know, you know. So it's just this. But anyway, there was the village.
Overabundance.
Yet overabundance, but the village, there's some principles that we can learn from these cultures there's a simplicity and there's a community culture, a village, that really just works. I don't know how to explain it to people, really.
Let me ask you, Lisa, have you been around American Indians in the Western Hemisphere, whether in the U.S. or Central America or anywhere else?
In the U.S. a little bit, yes. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Because when I lived in Suriname, so you have the Maroons, descendants of escaped slaves, and you have the Amerindians, the Trios, the Arawaks, and so forth. And I noticed that they were very reserved and, you know, they didn't throw open their arms and say, take that hut. Whereas people of African descent there and in Mother Africa itself, and I've worked in Nigeria and Liberia and, you know, a number of countries in Africa as a consultant, that people are always open and friendly. And you know, and I'm thinking, let's take Suriname. You know, if I was an Amerindian, as they're called there, I would probably hate white folks, just, you know, destroyed the forest, destroyed or destroying our cultures.
Yeah.
But if I was a descendant of a runaway slave, I would hate white people, but they didn't.
Yeah.
And they judge people by how they were today. And it's in my book, you know, the very first trip I took, this storm blew us to a village we weren't prepared to stop at, and terrible, you know, rain like you have in the rainforest. And this chief was, you know, going on and on haranguing in the Matawai language. I didn't know what he was saying. I thought he was saying, your ancestors enslaved mine and we hate you, get out of here. And what he was saying is, the ancestor spirits have sent one of you, at least one of you among the four in our group here to come to understand our ways and tell white people, we don't hate them. We just want to be free. And I said, yes, that's what I'm going to do for the next few years. I'm going to live with these people and learn their language. And I love the idea of, you know, hearing from the ancestral spirits, you know, maybe this will open up a magical world. And as you know, there's some, paranormal experiences in my book.
Well, there are, you know, you have to be open to it. You have to be, I think the U.S. and, you know, Western cultures are very cluttered with sound and noise and energy that is I'm going to get in trouble, but it's almost like a greed thing that's going on. So there's this and other layer of this sounds weird, but it's other layer of energy that is complete BS that we need to get rid of and strip away and get to the reality. And when you live in this country, the cultures, the Native American cultures, Black cultures, the Creoles, Cajuns, they understand the times. There's like this, they're more connected as community, I feel, in all cultures around the world, when you have to band together against anything really bad happening, wars and skirmishes, and maybe it's an epidemic or something, right? So we've been through that with COVID around the world, right? But we get right back onto that train of, you know, second homes and 10 cars or whatever it is. I'm exaggerating, people, sorry. But but
you're making your point.
I'm trying to really kind of get that point, because we seem that we have to exaggerate everything to make a point in this country. Whereas when you're in reality, you know, growing up in Africa, there were some very, I mean, there was exactly like you're saying, paranormal experiences. There's, but I don't think they're paranormal. I just think that we're more aware because you're living a simpler life, but it simpler doesn't mean stupid. Simpler means that your eyes are wide open. And you actually experience things in an uncluttered way. And on the Western front, we tend to clutter. So our senses aren't as clear, perhaps. Does that make sense?
And we fear being judged by our colleagues. I found out, you know, while writing this book, what do you know? There's a journal of paranormal anthropology. And I flipped through an issue, and these are the kind of stories that anthropologists will tell at an annual conference after, you know, at a party in the hotel after a number of drinks. They'll tell some weird stories that they would never publish for fear of being thought crazy or you've gone too native and he's irretrievable. But so that I think I was maybe opened to open-minded living with, to begin with, the Maroons of Suriname, to be open to this stuff and not to fear it. The first out-of-body experience that I describe in my book, I was at George Washington University, and my first feeling was, emotional reaction was, God, this is, I'm going crazy. This is terrible. My faith was against the wall. And yet I was looking all around the room, and yet my eyes were against the wall. How could this be happening? Then I said, wait a second. Maybe this is the spiritual experience you've been kind of hoping for your whole life. And maybe it's happening now. And I went on to have several.
Those, I have that all the time, even when I'm driving, which is really scary. It's really scary. Yet it is a way, it's like having a second body in a way.
I've come to believe in astral bodies. When this happened to me, I had no vocabulary. I didn't have a paradigm in which to, understand this, but I later read up on parapsychology and whatever you want to call it, psi phenomena. And, so I had a vocabulary.
I really do believe it is about understanding energies, and in anthropology, when you're starting to dig around things, you're digging into cultures, you're digging into history, you're digging into things that, I mean, even the movie The Exorcist, have you read about all that? What happened to The Exorcist? How people died on the set every time they tried to remake it, especially when they started going into Egypt and going into the ancient ruins areas to film?
I think I did hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, stuff happens, but I think when we become, over civilized, that's where we're stripping away these magical things that we actually have.
We become logical positivists, and we have to look at things scientifically. And if things happen that are outside of that paradigm, we get frightened. But I taught myself from that first one when I was transferring to GW University to like not be afraid. And maybe the most remarkable thing is when my good friend from high school in Korea, we ended up back in Washington. We both had PhDs, and he came down with cancer, and pretty soon we knew he was going to die. And he said, listen, if there's any way I can, we talked about eschatology, life after death. He said, if there's any proof of existence beyond the grave, I'll let you know. So I was in the Dominican Republic in my hotel. I'd just gotten into bed. Now I have to admit, I got a phone call from his wife saying that Wayne had died that morning. So here it was evening. We're on essentially the same time zone. And Wayne floated into my room and told me through telepathy, I suppose, that he was no longer in pain. And he was breaking all kinds of rules to even be there communicating with me. But isn't that the basis of our friendship in high school? We broke the rules. And then he asked me, if I had a, if I had a modem. And this was 1986 or seven. I didn't know what a modem was. He said, well, get a modem and I'll see if I can communicate with you that way.
Wow.
And, that was never any more communication from Wayne. But this was hours after he died, in the middle of the Caribbean, and he died in Northern Virginia. So I have a few stories like that. And I don't know how to explain them. I try to talk about William James and blah, blah, blah. But, who knows?
Well, that it's interesting because the military was, they had the internet in the 80s. We just didn't know about it as civilians. The 80s, it wasn't Google,
Yeah, my mentor, Russ Bernard, was one of the early guys, using phones to use the internet.
Isn't that wild?
That old system. Talking with his colleague at Cambridge University in England. So I was not and am not an early adopter of new technology.
Well, we've had to. I mean, with Nancy, my mom had a magazine in South Africa, and she had what was called the mothership. She had one of the first Apple computers. In fact, she printed out her own film for our magazine over there, or her magazine over there. And I mean, if you had to fix something, we were in Port Elizabeth, if you had a computer problem, we had to fly people in from Joburg to fix their computer. And then she went to print, and I remember she put the magazine on a disc, when back in the day called the floppy disc,
I
and took
remember.
it to the printer, and the printer, we drove to Cape Town, and the printers looked at her like she was absolutely insane. They're like, we don't do this technology yet. And she just, you know, moves ahead, not thinking these people haven't caught up yet. And then we really thought we were going to be way behind when we came back to the States and found out we really weren't. So it was kind of a, it's very interesting about what I think I, one thing I want to really instill in people is your memoir also reminds me to travel. It's so important to travel and truly travel and connect with the cultures. You know, do your resort thing and everything. But these experiences that you have had, you can't get it. I mean, other than reading your book and other books, right? You can't get it as much as if you can travel yourself and go.
Yourself,
and
yeah. Totally
even
agree.
One experience in your life, this is the biggest education you could ever have. And it's unexplainable education, like we're talking about. People are going to go, you guys got all woo-woo. Well, so what? Woo-woo's not a bad deal. So what? So long as you're not hurting anyone, right? So it's okay to expand our minds and souls and beings, and travel will do that. And it will serve you up the unexplainable. And that is the part of the magic. That's why we have different languages, but we're still all talking the same language. So, travel, whether it's for work, whether it's for fun, but get outside the typical resort, because that is just another fake little city of where you just came from, you know?
Like if you're a student, high school or college, you know, get a semester abroad experience and try to live with a local family.
Yeah,
that'd
those
be a great way to get started. And of course, the Peace Corps is another great way.
Yeah, it's so cool. We do have opportunities out there. But Ted, I really appreciate you joining on the show. This has been such an amazing conversation. And everyone, I want them to know it's Edward Greene is the author, and the book is called On the Fringe. That's such a good title, too, by the way. On the
Thank
Fringe,
you.
Not on the, you know, because I used to say fringe for bangs on your hair. On the Fringe. Anyway, but On the Fringe, Confessions of a Maverick Anthropologist. It is out now. Go get it, whether you want to read it on in paper, digitally, or listen to it. It's out. So thank you so much, Ted.
Okay, Lisa, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. Keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com.